From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2010, a deeply divided Supreme Court ruled the government could not ban corporations from spending money to support political candidates. The court majority said the First Amendment's right to free speech applied not just to people, but to large businesses. Today in the program, we're talking about whether a corporation is a person, at least when it applies to rights. Today is the deadline for Salt Lake City voters to cast their ballot on that question. It's a resolution proposed by a national effort called Move to Amend. Organizers say the Citizens United ruling has caused corporate money to flood into the election system and is limiting the influence of mainstream Americans. So we'll talk about the legal history of this issue, and we'll discuss the role that corporations should play in civic life after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A national movement emerged in the wake of the Citizens United ruling in 2010. That was when the Supreme Court said that corporations have the First Amendment right of free speech to spend as much money as they like in federal elections. The movement called Move to Amend is active throughout the country. So far in 500 cities, they've been able to pass resolutions calling for a constitutional amendment to reverse that ruling. Last year, organizers had enough signatures to get the resolution on the ballot in Salt Lake City, but Utah law does not allow resolutions like that if they don't result in an actual law. But the Salt Lake City Council did find a way around that law. They voted to allow city residents to mail in an opinion on the question of whether a corporation is a person. Today is the deadline to cast that ballot, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about the issue, the history of this question of corporate personhood, that's the term you're hearing a lot lately, and the role that corporations should play or could play in civic life. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to start with some historical perspective first. And joining us is Adam Winkler, a professor of constitutional law at the UCLA School of Law. He's written on corporate political speech rights. He's also the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. We've spoken to him before about that. And he's joining us today from a studio on the campus of UCLA. And Professor Winkler, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to start really in a basic way in terms of the history. When the founders drew up, you know, a right to free speech, did this idea of corporations or businesses having rights, did that really enter into the equation or into their mind at the time?
There's no evidence that the founding fathers ever considered whether the free speech guarantee or any of the other guarantees in the Constitution applied to corporations. There were very few corporations at the time of the founding. There have been estimates that there were only about a dozen corporations. They just simply did not play the role in the economy that they grew to play over the course of the next 100 years or so. So there's no evidence that the framers originally intended to protect corporations, but from the very early days of the American experiment, corporations were recognized to have some constitutional rights. As early as 1819, the Supreme Court first said that corporations were entitled to some constitutional protections.
I want to ask you about that 1819 ruling. The language in the decision is pretty interesting. It was written by Chief Justice John Marshall. And he wrote this. He said that a corporation was an artificial being, invisible, intangible, and existing only in contemplation of law. Explain what that means.
Well, that's right. What Chief Justice John Marshall was referring to is the fact that a corporation is a being for various legal purposes. The very reason why corporations were first developed, really in England in the 1600s, was so that they could have a legal identity. Hmm. Basically, the problem was a person dies, and when the person dies, their property then has to go to someone else. A corporation was the idea of a corporation was you could create a legal fiction, a legal person mm-hmm. that could hold property rights without having to transfer that property every time someone died. So the corporation would sort of live on forever, and it could hold property rights. It could sue and be sued in a court of law. It could form contracts. But it was always a fiction. It was not a real person. Yeah. It was an invisible, intangible, artificial person designed for various legal purposes.
And has that idea stuck? This idea that it's a fiction, or because now you hear of, I just want to get a sense of what you're making of the language, because you hear this a lot, the question of whether a corporation is a person. Is that even a proper way of talking about all of this?
Well, the reason why it may be a proper way to talk about it is from the perspective of the law. When the corporation first arose, the law didn't know how to handle the idea of an organization that would have its own rights, like a right to have property.
Right.
And so lawyers used this sort of simple shorthand of saying, well, it's a legal person. It's not a person. It's not a human being. No one thought it was a human being. No one thinks that it can exercise moral judgment and it can't be imprisoned if it does something wrong. But that for a variety of legal purposes, that it would be considered to be like a person and could stand in for a person if you wanted to, for instance, sue the corporation. You wouldn't have to sue the individual people who constitute the corporation. You could sue the corporation itself. And in some ways, we still think of corporations in this way, just as a matter of common thought and common language. You refer to the Coca-Cola company, and you might refer to it as having an attitude or a corporate culture or a product in a possessive way. That's kind of like how we think about people.
The 14th Amendment comes along, and in Section 1, we get this guarantee of due process and equal protection to persons. I'm wondering if this starts to change the way we're thinking about persons. Are we starting to evolve this idea of who gets access to due process and equal protection? Are corporations or businesses or organizations being folded in at this point?
That's exactly what happens. It's really one of the most remarkable stories in American constitutional law. So the 14th Amendment is added to the Constitution right after the Civil War, and it was designed to give rights to the freedmen, to require states to respect the equal protection of the laws, to give them due process of law. And what happens is about 20 years after it's adopted, a man named Roscoe Conkling, who was a high-profile Republican leader at the time, goes to the Supreme Court. And he argues in a case dealing with the Southern Pacific Railroad that the framers of the 14th Amendment used the word person because they wanted to include not just the freedmen, but also business corporations who had been considered, at least since that 1819 Supreme Court case, to be legal persons for at least some reasons. Now, Conkling makes this argument on behalf of the Southern Pacific Railroad, and he has unusual persuasive force in the Supreme Court. Conkling himself had been nominated to the Supreme Court twice, including just a few months before he appeared in oral argument at the Supreme Court. And in fact, he was confirmed by the Senate just a few months before he had made that argument in the Supreme Court. And he decided not to serve because he said he was making too much money as a lawyer for the railroads. And he was the last person ever to turn down a seat on the Supreme Court after the Senate had confirmed him. And Conkling himself also was one of the framers of the 14th Amendment. He had been on the committee of 15 members of Congress that had drafted the 14th Amendment. So when he said we intended to protect corporations, he had a lot of persuasive force. And to help matters, he pulled out what he claimed to be a secret, never-before-published journal of the committee's deliberations over the 14th Amendment that he said proved that they had intended to protect business corporations. It turns out that his argument was highly misleading, but in a couple years after that case, the Supreme Court agreed and effectively said that corporations were persons for purposes of the 14th Amendment and thus entitled to due process and equal protection. The cruel irony of it was that exact same Supreme Court spent those years robbing African Americans and the freedmen of the same protections it was now granting to business corporations.
That ruling that you mentioned, the Southern Pacific Railroad in Santa Clara County, the court does make a distinction, for example, and you mentioned this. They do rule that corporations, unlike individuals, don't, for example, have the Fifth Amendment right against incrimination. So they don't have all the rights. They don't exactly become persons in terms of their rights.
Well, that's right. In terms of corporate constitutional rights, you know, before 2010 and the Citizens United case that you started with the introduction, you know, no one really thought that much about corporations and whether they had constitutional rights. Yeah. But the court itself had been ruling on these issues for about 200 years. And the court had said that the corporations have some rights, they don't have other rights. And the court really sort of went about it in a confused way without sort of a coherent approach to the problem. In many cases, the court said corporations are people for purposes of the 14th Amendment, for instance, in the Santa Clara case and cases that came after that. In other cases, and especially beginning in the 20th century, the court kind of moves away from the idea that corporations are people, and that's why they have constitutional rights, and starts to adopt an argument that looks more like corporations are associations of people, of real people. And those real people, the shareholders, the employees, the directors, and the managers, they all have constitutional rights uncontroversially, and so that they should be entitled to exercise those rights in an organizational form in the same way that members of the NAACP or members of the NRA or members of Planned Parenthood can all exercise their rights together as an organization.
You make this point that there were these efforts that go on in the late 19th and early 20th century about sort of limiting the influence of corporations. But you say it wasn't about limiting political power of corporations, that it was really about protecting the owners and shareholders in companies from this, you know, you write about this growing class of these professional executives who were spending, you know, the shareholders' money.
Well, that's right. It's a more complicated story than we often think. So the very first campaign finance laws were adopted right around the beginning of the 20th century, and they were specific limits on corporations making expenditures in election campaigns. And because this is the progressive era, a time when there was a lot of anti-corporate fervent, many people often look at these laws and say, oh, that was an effort to try to restrict money from influencing elections, that corporations had become like Frankenstein's monster, haunting the town, a sort of fictional person who was nonetheless bent on destroying its creator. But the story was a little bit more complicated. At the early 20th century, we're seeing what came to be known as the separation of ownership and control in modern corporations, where it used to be corporations were just owned by a little family that would organize and run its affairs. But by the turn of the century, we had the real rise of huge national corporations that had a huge number of sort of passive shareholders and were run by professional managers. And at this time, really the primary argument against corporate political expenditures was not that corporations were too big and too powerful, although clearly that was part of the story, but that corporate managers and directors shouldn't be able to spend other people's money to support electoral politics. And many people thought that that money was being spent to buy laws that would protect corporate managers from the oversight of the owners and the shareholders. Mm. And so part of the idea there was that of campaign finance law was, again, that the corporation was an association, not a person, but an association in which we needed to protect some members of the association, the shareholders, from being misused or abused by other members of the corporation, like the directors and the managers.
You make this argument that despite the Citizens United ruling, the fact is, you say, corporations don't really have free speech in a number of ways because all corporations operate under the dictates of corporate law. And really, a corporation is bound by all kinds of things. One of them, of course, is the idea of maximizing the wealth of shareholders. It's not entirely free, this idea.
Well, that's right. Even when we talk about something like the freedom of a corporation, we have to recognize that the freedom that a corporation have is a legally granted freedom. It's a freedom that is really controlled and mandated by law. So if you and I decide we want to make political expenditures or take a stand on politics, we can be governed by whatever we choose to be governed by. We can be governed by our own selfish interests. I want to do something like lower my taxes so I have more money at the end of the day. I might decide I want to be other regarding. I want to pay maybe higher taxes because I think that I need to do more to help the people who aren't getting an education have the funds so that they can get an educated. I can make that choice for myself. That's part of my freedom. A corporation doesn't have that freedom. A corporation is required by law to pursue the interests of shareholders. So when a corporation exercises speech, it's not really doing so freely. It's doing so under the compulsion of law to pursue the interests of shareholders. And if a corporation makes expenditures that don't advance the interests of the shareholders and the interests of the corporation, under the formalities of the law, it could be held to be a violation of the corporation's duties and held to be invalid corporate action that has to be overturned.
Mm. Let me ask you this. I want to come back around to this move to amend movement. Get your perspective on that. I mean, a lot of the focus in this amendment right now is on this question of whether or not a corporation is a person, you know, this corporate personhood issue, which you have said that's not exactly the problem, that if you want to solve what you see as, you know, corruption or problems within the system, I think you're saying that there's another way of going about it.
That's right. You know, corporate personhood has been an incredibly helpful organizing idea for the Move to Amend people and other reformers who've responded to Citizens United. It just seems for many people wrong that a corporation would be thought of as a person just like you and me. And I understand that idea. But I think that the effort to amend the Constitution to change corporate personhood, to eliminate, as the constitutional amendments that have been proposed do, to eliminate all corporate constitutional rights, I think that's a mistake. And it's a mistake for a variety of reasons. One, there's just a practical problem. You could read Citizens United over and over again. You could play it backwards on your record player like an old Beatles album or something. And what you won't find ever is the words corporate personhood. The court does not rely on the idea that the corporation is a person. What the court says in that case is that a corporation is an association of people, just like the NAACP or the NRA or Planned Parenthood, and thus they have those people have constitutional rights that they can exercise. I also think that over and above that sort of small pragmatic concern, like it doesn't actually respond to Citizens United, Citizens United could conceivably come out the exact same way even after an amendment destroying constitutional rights for corporations because those underlying people still have their rights. I think that there's a broader problem. You know, we don't often think about it in these terms, but we want corporations to have free speech rights, at least some corporations and at least some free speech rights. Mm-hmm. The New York Times is a corporation. Fox News is a corporation. Do we really want to say corporations have no constitutional rights and thus effectively empower the government to censor the New York Times or to censor Fox News? That seems really antithetical to our notions of free speech. Corporations need to have some constitutional rights, like the right to property and even some limited right to free speech. Where the reform movement should be focusing its energies, if you ask me, is on amending the Constitution to allow government more leeway to regulate campaign finance. The problem is a campaign finance problem, not a problem of corporations and their constitutional rights.
That's Adam Winkler. He is a professor of constitutional law at the UCLA School of Law, the author of the book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And Professor, thank you very much for taking the time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
801-585-WEST is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today is the deadline for Salt Lake City voters to cast their ballot on a question of whether or not a corporation is a person. It's a resolution proposed by the group Move to Amend. It's a national campaign that says our system of government is broken because of the money and power wielded by big business. The aim is a constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not speech. So we're looking at the legal history of corporations, asking what role they should play in civic life today. Joining us now on the program is Paul Sherman. He's a senior attorney with the libertarian law firm Institute for Justice. He litigates constitutional cases with a focus on the First Amendment and other civil liberties. He also writes the Institute's Congress Shall Make No Law Free Speech blog. And Paul Sherman is joining us from his office in Arlington, Virginia. Paul Sherman, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess we should start with this idea, the sort of the lingo that you hear in this effort. You know, money is not speech. Corporations aren't people. You say, OK, yes, those are true. I mean, you cop to those, but you say they don't really have anything to do with whether political spending is protected by the First Amendment. You're sort of parsing the way this is being expressed, I suppose. What do you mean?
Sure. So I think both of those statements, money isn't speech and corporations aren't people, are true statements. There's no denying those. But really, those are slogans that don't have a lot of meaning when it comes to resolving this First Amendment question. I'll start with corporations aren't people.
Yeah.
Obviously, corporations are not people, but they don't have First Amendment rights because we think that they're people. They have First Amendment rights because people have First Amendment rights, and they don't surrender those rights when they associate with one another, even if they choose to associate in the corporate form. In fact, the First Amendment expressly protects both speech and association. Now, on the concept that money isn't speech, again, that's true. Money is property, but there are all sorts of property that facilitate the exercise of our constitutional rights. The government could no more say that, paper and ink aren't speech, they're property, than it can say money isn't speech. Or to put it another way, UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh has pointed out that money is not abortion. But if the Supreme Court has said that you have the right to have an abortion, a state can't get around that by saying, well, you can have an abortion as long as nobody pays for it.
So even though an object itself may not be speech, if the government regulates it because it's being used to enable free speech, it becomes a First Amendment issue. You're just worried about the way this is being framed.
Well, I mean, that's exactly right. I'm not so concerned that people are going to go out there and say, oh, money isn't speech, corporations aren't people. What I'm really concerned about is what are going to be the more operative provisions of any kind of constitutional amendment that might be proposed. Because ultimately what we're talking about here is when should the government be allowed to ban or limit peaceful political activity?
Right.
Now, under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, I think the answer to that pretty clearly is never or almost never. And I think that's worked out for us pretty well for over 200 years. This constitutional amendment, if it were to pass, would be the first time in American history when we have revised the Bill of Rights to restrict human liberty. I think that is a dangerous and, frankly, totally unnecessary step.
Should the government... I guess the question always comes up, though. This is often a reaction to the amount of money that's being spent in the American political system. And you yourself, I seem in some way, when I'm reading you, you seem concerned about that. So I guess the question is, what do you make of the level of spending in politics, and when can the government regulate that, or should it step in at some point?
Well, I'll answer the second part of that question first. I think under the First Amendment, the government has no business trying to regulate the amount of money that people spend on peaceful political expression.
Yeah.
That's because what these corporations and individuals, most of this money is being spent by wealthy individuals, what they're doing is they're not handing out $20 bills to voters. They're spending this money on political ads that are designed to persuade voters. But whether that ultimately works or not is up to the voter. The voter is an independent check on that kind of power. Now, in terms of what we can do to reduce the level of spending in politics, if that's something that we're really concerned about, I think we have to look at it from completely the opposite perspective and ask, why is so much money spent on politics? And I think the reason why so much money is spent on politics is because we have an enormously powerful government that is able to pass regulations virtually without constitutional check from the judiciary, and it's been that way for decades now. If we want to get the money out of politics, we have to get the politics out of money.
You've said that you don't think it's necessarily the case that money corrupts, and you've pointed out, this is interesting, you say that six of the best governed states in the nation were states that have allowed unlimited corporate and union political spending. You say money doesn't necessarily corrupt.
That's correct. And social scientists, political scientists have tried to find a link between campaign spending and political corruption for decades, and they've never been able to demonstrate one. I think an important thing to remember is that before Citizens United was decided, the rule that it announced, that corporations and unions are allowed to spend unlimited amounts on political speech, was already the rule in a majority of American states. And there's no evidence whatsoever that those states were systematically more corrupt or less well-governed than states with stricter campaign finance laws. And we can even see this when we look internationally. Australia, for example, has virtually no campaign finance laws. They practically have no disclosure laws. Yet Australia is a thriving Western democracy, and by some measures, Transparency International's, it has lower levels of political corruption than the United States does.
Do you believe money buys elections? Because you've suggested this idea is a myth.
I believe that it is a myth. I think the only thing that money buys is the opportunity to get a message out to the voters. Whether that message ultimately succeeds is up to the voters. And I think we can look at the 2012 elections as a great example of the power of voters to resist these messages. Even though Republicans enormously outspent Democrats through super PACs and through 501c4 organizations, Democrats maintained control of both houses of Congress, and the Democratic president was reelected.
So the move to amend organizers and other critics of the Citizens United ruling, you've said they need to go beyond these slogans. You know, money is not speech and corporations are not people, and they should focus on the real issue at stake. And I wanted to come back to that because you've sort of stated this. The real issue, you say, is this idea of when a government does step in or should step in to regulate political contributions, political expenditures, even if they are speech. Do you have a sense of where that boundary might be?
Well, I don't think there's any boundary because I don't think it's any of the government's business to try and restrict political contributions or expenditures. But in terms of what campaign finance proponents should do, or what I think they're obliged to do under the First Amendment, I think they have to come forward with real evidence that there's a real problem and that these laws will really ameliorate the problem. And they simply haven't been able to do that. And again, you can just look at the comparison of various different states. There are some states, like Utah, I believe, which has no contribution limits whatsoever. But Utah is not a particularly corrupt state. It's certainly not more corrupt than a vast number of states that have very restrictive contribution limits.
Mm. So how do you, if this is the problem, politics, you should get politics out of the money. Have you thought about what that means? What are the reforms that you have in mind, or what are the mechanisms for dealing with that, the problem as you state it?
Absolutely. The real problem and what has led to the situation we're in now is that for decades we have had a judiciary that has consistently refused to enforce constitutional limits on government power. And this is really something that started in the New Deal, but it has continued for decades since. And as a result, Congress and the executive have virtually unchecked authority. You know, it's an old maxim that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I agree with that. And I think we should be concerned about political corruption. I think one of the best ways to address it is to get courts back in the business of enforcing constitutional limits on government power.
That's Paul Sherman. He's a senior attorney with the law firm Institute for Justice in Arlington, Virginia, joined us by phone from his office there. Mr. Sherman, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take another break, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today is the deadline for Salt Lake City voters to cast their ballot on a question of whether a corporation is a person. This is a resolution proposed by the organization Move to Amend, who's trying to deal with what they see as corruption in the system of government, broken, because they say, because of the fact that money and power is wielded by big businesses and corporations. Those ballots can be returned in person to the city recorder's office. They can be postmarked by 5 o'clock today. We'll give you details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're talking about the issue behind all of this today. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now is Ashley Sanders, who is a spokesperson for the National Move to Amend campaign. She's the co-founder of Move to Amend Salt Lake City, and she is joining us today from Vancouver, British Columbia. She's on a speaking tour there. And Ashley Sanders, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So I wanted to start this idea that a corporations that are, you know, run by real people, how does that transform if a corporation is run by real folks, obviously, how does that transform their capacity to speak out as a collective voice on matters that are significant to them? How is it that a corporation isn't a person? What's your sort of basic sense of all of that?
Well, corporations are comprised of people, and we at Move to Amend believe that all of those people, whether I agree with them or not, have constitutional rights to speak and to argue and to decide in our democracy. But a corporation itself is not a person, and in fact, it's nothing like a person. It doesn't live, it doesn't breathe, it doesn't die, it doesn't need love or clean air or clean water to live, and it's primary goal, as identified by the Supreme Court, is to amass enormous amounts of money.
Right.
So if you have an entity whose goal is to make money at any cost, and that corporation is also given limited liability, so it's not fully responsible for its actions, you've created a very, very, very powerful organization. And then if you give that organization human rights, you have essentially endangered human rights for regular people.
How? How have you endangered human rights for regular people if you give a corporation a human right?
Well, at Move to Amend, our tagline is "End corporate rule, legalize democracy." And people often laugh and say, "Oh, that's really clever," but we're actually very serious about that. Because if I go to exercise my right, for example, to pass a law in my city that protects health or welfare or safety, and a corporation doesn't like it, the corporation can come back and say that I violated its 14th Amendment rights to equal protection, or that I violated its 5th Amendment rights, and that I've committed a takings against its profit, or that I've offended its 1st Amendment rights to freedom of speech. And that corporation can use its constitutional rights that it never should have had as a trump card to say that me exercising my democratic rights has threatened its democratic rights.
Mm.
But a corporation never was supposed to have constitutional rights. It was supposed to have privileges that we, the people, granted to it.
What do you make of the history? I wanted to get your sense of that. We were talking to Professor Adam Winkler earlier to get his sense of how this idea of, you know, corporate personhood has evolved. I wanted to get your sense of that because you've talked about there's that case from you mentioned that in the 1970s, corporate America was sort of looking for ways to secure power. So they began this corporate free speech movement. And I'm getting a sense that what you're thinking is that there was this very deliberate attempt by corporations to take these various rights, free speech being one of them. I wanted to see if you could explain all of that to us.
Definitely. So to do that, we have to go back to the beginning of this country and recognize that when the constitutional framers wrote the Constitution, it began with the phrase, "we the people." And technically, that should have read, "we the legal persons," because legal persons get incredible benefits in a democracy. They get the protections and the rights enumerated in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So being a person is a very good thing to be, a legal person. And in the beginning of this country, many of the people who fought in the revolution were not just fighting concentrated political tyranny in the form of the king, they were also fighting concentrated economic tyranny in the form of corporations like the British East India Company. And when the revolution was over, they knew that it wasn't enough just to protect their basic political rights with a founding political document. They also had to protect their economic sovereignty through people's laws that protected their economic rights. And they did very powerful things to protect their economic rights. Back in the first 75 years of the country, in order to get chartered, a corporation had to get a bill passed through the state legislature that said it could exist. And in order to do that, it had to prove that it served the public good, which is a very, very profound idea, that the economy should exist for people rather than people for the economy. And there were lots of other stringent laws on the books. Corporations, shareholders had to be local. They could only exist for a limited amount of time before they had to renew their charters. Their books had to be open. They could make a certain amount of money, and then their corporation was returned to the hands of the people. And for many years, it was actually a felony for corporations to donate a single penny in elections. And corporations wanted more power, and they didn't like those laws. And so during the Civil War, they got very, very powerful, and they used the chaos of war to drive themselves more and more into the fabric of society. But even after the war, they could not lessen these political restraints that people had placed on them. And so they very deliberately sat down and decided that they would go to the least accountable, most undemocratic, and most remote branch of the federal government, the judicial branch, because they knew that it would be easier to convince 9 Supreme Court justices, unelected justices, that they had rights than it would be the entire American people. And they very deliberately went to the courts, and they used very boring, very tedious cases to argue, you know, for tax laws on the one hand, and on the other hand, to argue that they were people under the law. These entities that are not even mentioned in the Constitution suddenly argue that they have the same rights as living, breathing human beings. And in 1886, they took a case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad to the courts. And they didn't even argue it. They just made some comments before the case even began. The court reporter wrote it down. And bam, that is how corporations became people under the law. It was never decided by you and me. It wasn't even decided in a court. It was just talked about in some opening arguments. And so they actually used the 14th Amendment to argue that they were people. And this was a very cynical move because the 14th Amendment had just been passed to protect the rights of recently emancipated black people in this country. And so we see throughout history this tension between the people who were not included in the phrase "we the people" from the beginning, fighting to get their rights, and then corporations co-opting those people's rights to get a trump card over those people's movements themselves. So many people are familiar with Citizens United, but this story actually stretches way back to 1886 when corporations first got rights, and they've since gotten First Amendment rights to freedom of speech, Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizure, Fifth Amendment rights against takings, and of course the 14th Amendment right to protect from discrimination. And this has been very deliberate. Corporations have very strategically and very deliberately constructed their power because they knew that people's movements were threatening to them, and they knew that they needed some trump card to exercise over those movements in case they got too powerful. And in the 1970s, Lewis Powell and other people in the Chamber of Commerce decided to respond to the uprisings of the 1960s by creating a very coordinated plan to get power back for the very wealthy. And part of their plan was to take cases to the court to demand the most basic, sacrosanct freedom in a democracy, the freedom of speech, and to equate it with money so that they had a giant permission slip to dump corporate cash into our elections and control the message, control the decisions, and control the laws.
Ashley, let me ask you, it seems like in some way what you're saying when you say corporations, it's the money-making aspect that seems to, in your mind anyway, disqualify them from access to certain rights. And I'm wondering, the court, of course, in Citizens United wasn't just referring to corporations. They were also referring to unions, for example. Do you think unions have free speech rights?
A union as an entity does not have constitutional free speech rights. At Move to Amend, our amendment, which is in Congress right now, the We the People Amendment, expressly articulates that we are talking about all artificial entities, whether they be nonprofits or unions or corporations. An entity itself does not have rights. An entity has privileges that people give it, and the people within those entities are free to exercise their democratic rights. What we want is a democracy where people have a roughly equal chance of participating in the debate and influencing the outcome of a decision. And when entities rule, that general equality is completely perverted and turned on its head.
You get the question has come up whether or not you have people who support the concept of dealing with all of the money and all of the corruption within an election system. The question is whether or not the move to amend idea is the best option to deal with all of this. And I wanted to give you a sense to respond. For example, Adam Weekler earlier on the program talked about the fact that corporations having no rights is not the shouldn't really be your focus. What you should be focusing on is finding a way to get the system to get a system that regulates campaign finance law, that you're not fighting the right fight. How do you respond to that?
I'd respond to that by telling two stories. Democracy Unlimited, which is one of the founding organizational members of Move to Amend, actually did just that. In Northern California, we passed a ballot initiative that the vast majority of Northern Californians agreed with that said that we didn't want any non-local corporate contributions in elections. And we did that as, you know, voicing the will of the people. And corporations came back and sued us for creating that law because it violated their First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and to spending money. So the truth is that we can't pass robust, meaningful campaign finance legislation or truly robust legislation of almost any kind when corporations have rights, because they will reverse those gains that people make to protect their communities by asserting their rights.
So this is
the second story, I would say.
This is a systemic thing then. That what you're saying is you've got to deal with the system before you handle any of that stuff.
Absolutely. We're taking our, you know, a page from the playbook of past social movements who knew that, you know, when the game is rigged, you have to change the rules. And this is not an issue of corruption. Corruption happens when the rules are good and certain people abuse them. This is an issue of structural corruption and structural legalized, institutionalized bribery and corporations taking over every meaningful part of our democratic process and every meaningful part of our lives. So to get power back to make the laws that can protect the health and safety and welfare of our communities and our country, we have to amend the Constitution to change the rules of the game and get back to a place where the people actually have a voice.
Seems like the focus for you is not on the federal level. You're focusing on the state level. Is that right?
Our ultimate goal is a federal amendment, but we know that, you know, the women suffragettes didn't walk into a male-exclusive Congress and say, hey, could we have an amendment giving us the right to vote and giving us equality? They built a grassroots movement using every tool in the toolbox, and we're doing the same thing. We're starting at the grassroots level in our local communities where we have the most power, and we are using ballot initiatives, which is one of the most direct forms of democracy that we have, to ask regular people, not people in suits, regular people like you and me, if they think corporations have too much power and if they believe we should amend the Constitution. And we're doing that in Salt Lake with our ballot initiative that's going on right now and ending today, where people can vote on whether they think we should amend the Constitution. But and that allows us to organize and educate and go door to door and talk to people. And then we take it to the county level, then to the state. And then ultimately we use the grassroots power that we've built to actually drive an amendment into what is essentially a corporate occupied Congress.
So essentially you're saying we're taking steps, step after step. Because, I mean, the idea is the ballot is an opinion. The thing, you know, this is an opinion. It has no force of law. So you're explaining the value, yes, that it doesn't necessarily do anything now, but it's an expression of will and that'll move us to the next step.
Exactly. I often remind people that the Declaration of Independence was actually just a resolution. But resolutions can be very powerful ways of organizing and mobilizing people who are outraged at the loss of their democracy. And we've also chosen ballot initiative resolutions because, as I shared in the story before, we aren't actually able to pass laws that actually restrict corporate spending effectively on the local level because corporations have constitutional rights. The Supreme Court gave them rights, and they use those rights to basically stomp on the laws that we try to pass.
Mm. So you have more than 500 communities have ballot initiatives like this, 13 states now. What's the next step? What's the next part for you?
Well, I'm in Washington right now touring, and Washington State is actually collecting 360,000 signatures in the next year to get on the 2014 ballot so that people can vote on the state level via a ballot initiative about amending the Constitution. So our goal is to do the daily, dogged, nuts and bolts work of organizing masses of American people and collaborating with all different groups that are impacted by corporate rule to actually build a mighty grassroots movement that is capable of changing the basic structures of this country, getting us back to where we were before the Supreme Court erroneously gave corporations rights, which they never should have had, but also talking about what is the world that we want? What kind of democratic laws and cultures and alternatives would we replace this corporate system with? So we're trying to also capture people's vision for a better world and articulate it in law.
That's Ashley Sanders. She's the co-founder of Move to Amend Salt Lake City. And let me remind you, today is the deadline for Salt Lake City voters to submit their ballot on the opinion question on corporate personhood. Those ballots can be returned in person to the city recorder's office. They can be postmarked by 5 o'clock today. And we have more information about all of that by just going to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll put a link to the Move to the Amend website as well. Ashley Sanders, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Taylor Almond. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.